has anything. I found Barnes & Noble had one copy of Ted Anders' book that's on this list, which I've not read, but I looked through it. It's interesting work. He does a lot of things with animal totems and a wealth. It's a huge book, a wealth of information. So that's probably a good one, and I put it on the list for you. I think you'll have to ask for these to be ordered if there's anything that you want from this list. I called Brass Unicorn and they didn't have anything, and I checked elsewhere. There just wasn't much that you could just walk in and pick up, so this will give you a place to start. I think there are a few more things. You just kind of have to search for them. Well, I thought I'd start by sharing a little bit with you what it was in my life that kind of connected me to animals and how it is that I kind of developed what I use as communication. In the work that I do with people, I have some clients who call me to work with their animals, or if people have lost an animal or an animal's ill or it's, you know, left for a few days or something like that, that kind of work. And I've had very good results. And at first, when I began doing this, I wasn't sure whether I could really use it as part of the other kind of psychic or intuitive work that I do. But it's actually very easy, and I'm going to give you a list from one lady's technique. Hers is basically exactly what I do. I wasn't quite sure how to put mine in words, and when I looked up Penelope Smith's work, I thought, well, this is it. You know, this is very similar, so I just kind of reiterated that. There's just a few steps, and so you'll be able to practice it and kind of play with it, and it doesn't take long, and then you have it as a skill that you can use if you'd like to. So when I was a kid, I grew up on a ranch, as most of you know, and a lot of my hours when my chores were done were spent out in the orchards just rambling or sitting in the high grass if Dad hadn't plowed yet and watching what happened around me. And we had any number of different animals, from quail and pheasant to jackrabbits to deer. We had some coyotes that would come in on occasion. Any number of wild birds, especially hawks, one of my very favorites. And I learned that if I was just still, these animals would come up and sit and look at me. And that's how I began to kind of communicate with them, just by watching them. And I had an empathic feeling is the best way to describe it, where I intuitively knew what they were after, what they needed, or what they wanted, what they were thinking. Sometimes it was a feeling of I was the animal. I don't know how else to describe that, but it's that empathic thing that children have when they're very small. And this stayed with me probably until, I'd say, between fourth and sixth grades when I noticed a shift. And when I would talk to the adults about that, especially my dad, because he was out in the orchards a lot, he didn't know what I was talking about. And I don't know still if it's that he didn't want to own up to the fact that he could do this as well, or he really didn't do it. I don't know. I have a feeling he didn't want to really talk about it. But anyway, when I would talk to Mom or my other family about it, you know, I learned quickly that no one else seemed to be doing that. And I was the oldest, so I didn't. My sister and my brothers were way too little and very active, where I'd be out there by myself. So I think they weren't really doing that at the time. Excuse me. But I had a number of pets, as we all do as kids. But I had everything from owls and coons to crows, blackbirds. My brother had pigeons. These were all wild animals. Sometimes they would be wounded and I would find them on the property and, you know, demand that my mother, who was an RN, help me fix this animal, you know. And I'm sure I must have driven her nuts many times, but my brother had the ability to call wild pigeons to him when he got older, when he was about second and third grade. And he had one, a fabulous male pigeon, just a handsome, handsome bird, that, boy, when David was home, that bird knew it and Pidge flew in. And when David would go for bike rides, Pidge would ride on his shoulder or fly behind him. It was quite remarkable. The owl that I had, you know, would sit on my arm or my shoulder. It wasn't a barn owl, which can be a quite large owl, but a smaller one, maybe a burrowing owl, I'm not sure. But he was the most loving little creature. You know, you could pull him up and caress him against your neck, and he would just snuggle in, kind of like a cat. I never dreamed that a raptor with these big claws, you know, and this formidable beak could become that close, but I just had no fear as a child. My mother was terrified that he'd dig out my eyes, or you know, the old thing about you get too close and you're going to lose your ear or lose your eye or lose part of your face or something. But he never harmed me, and he stayed for a very long time even after he was healed. My sister had a deep connection with one of the raccoons, and my father finally gave in and built us a huge thing around one of our apricot trees so our coon could have its natural home, you know, but we could still come and talk to him until he got healed. Somebody had trapped it, and so it had, you know, damaged a leg and stuff like that. So that communication thing for me was very natural. I had lots of memories of knowing where the quail nest was, or the rabbits, the mother rabbit kind of looking at me, and I could hear that she was going to tell me where the babies were, and if I walked softly, I would find them all snuggled up in a little grass nest and things like that. I think a lot of that is intuitive awareness, but even as adults, you can reawaken that part of yourself with just a little bit of work and a desire, you know, and an understanding that we're all family. These are like, to me, they've always been like my younger brothers and sisters. When I was a child, I felt no distinction at all. I felt like they were just part of my family, you know, part of life. But as I grew older, those feelings kind of changed, and I always have this feeling of them as being the younger members of the family. Well, when I went away to school, college, I lost that connection. I didn't have any animals for quite a while, and I look back at that now, and I think the loneliness, depression, some of the illnesses I experienced, I think a lot of that came as a result of not having nature in my life, living in an apartment in a city, and doing all the wild and crazy things that college students do, you know, everything that's available to you on the palate at that time. The first animal connection I had came after I was married to Bert, and we got a wonderful golden Persian named Brandy. And I always said it was my son's birthday present, but really it's because I'm so connected to cats, I just can't live without one. And so he came into our lives. And he stayed with us for 13 years. And rather than myself, Brandy adopted Scott. And he was a very large cat. He weighed about 15 pounds, solid muscle. And when Scott was born, or rather when Scott was about 3, I guess, Brandy knew when he was taking a nap and when he should be awake. And when he overslept, he got very worried. And he would go sit in front of the door, just sit. He never made a noise or anything, staring at the door. And if I didn't get it, you know, he would turn that big golden head and shine those amber eyes on me like, you better get in here and check my boy, you know, right now. And there were just some wonderful things that happened with Scott as a little boy and that big old cat. When we moved from Sacramento to Atascadero, Brandy behaved like a dog. He seemed to know that the property we had was being invaded by a lot of other dogs, and we didn't have one, so he became rather dog-like. I've seen him run off very large dogs, like a Labrador, and you know, he had massive amounts of fur, and when you have that all puffed up, he did look pretty big and pretty imposing, but he never got hurt. He always knew when he had done his work, and then he would fly up a tree and watch to be sure the dog left. And that was his purpose, I think. We'll talk about purpose for animals in a little bit. One of the little things I want to share with you is how humans in general, I think, have what I think it might be Penelope Smith that calls it a human superiority complex. And that's really what we do have about animals a lot of the time, thinking that we're more intelligent than they are. And I want to share this quote for you, with you. She says, "Because animals cannot write letters and play the guitar does not mean they're unintelligent, just as humans are not less intelligent because they cannot fly like birds or run as fast as cheetahs." I love that comparison. It really gets your attention. You know, that we all have different bodies, but they're all built for certain special things. She says, "These things are the result of body differences only, not mental capacity." And she talks a lot in her work about if you think animals aren't smart, you should just observe someone who has a pet that does only what it wants to do, stays where it wants to stay, or sleeps where it wants to sleep, or comes when it wants. And it's people label those animals as dumb or ditzy, and you know, far from that, they're probably extremely smart and know exactly how to move their person the way they want to move their person. So, and I often think that cats in particular, Scamp is a little different. She's really an evolved animal, I think, but some of the cats that I've had throughout my life have regarded me as their person. They're certainly not my cat, but I'm definitely their person, you know. I think some of you have probably had that experience. And one other thing that Penelope said that I really liked is this. The same spiritual being inhabiting a human body and using it to design and build houses would create a nest of leaves and twigs if he or she had a bird's body. He or she would still be the same intelligent being, but would be using a different body according to its physical capacities. And she is one of those people who really has that idea of the oneness of all life, or the unity of all life, in her heart and in her life. It's very present. It's not something she talks about, but she's living like that. So another point that's good to remember is that animals do have different levels of intelligence and different capabilities or talents, just like people do. So if you're having difficulty communicating or receiving communication from your animal, it might be because this lifetime your animal feels like just being a horse or a cat or a dog. They're just into their horseness this time, or their pigness, you know, or whatever it is. But some of them really love to connect with humans and really like sharing that space with their human and communicating. The dog that we had before we moved over here was my son's Springer Spaniel named Monty. And he really told me and taught me about dogs. I didn't care for Springers in particular. I thought they were kind of silly animals with lots of grooming that probably had to happen and big slobbery mouths, you know, and all this stuff. And into my life came Monty, who adopted my son, absolutely adored Scott. This was the most magnificent dog. He had a deep, marvelous chest and a noble head. He never slobbered. He was very meticulous about his coat. He loved being groomed. And he would sit in front of me and just look at me with those deep brown eyes. And all I had to do was just alter my consciousness slightly, and out of him would come these amazing teachings. And he always used to ask me if I was beginning to understand about dogs and how wonderful they are, and that he knew that one of the reasons he came was to teach me about that, even though it was, he was supposed to be Scott's dog, you know. He came to teach me, and he really did. This was a dog, it's really true, isn't it, Lori? This is a dog who had no training. He was so evolved that when he came, I might say, you know, well, you can sit on that rug by the door, and he would go, okay, and he'd sit there. And then he would begin to low crawl, and you'd see this dog face peeping around the chair. And, you know, he would see the fire in the fireplace in our home in Atascadero, and he would look at the fire, and then he'd look at me, and he'd look at the fire, and look at me, and then he'd low crawl a little more. It was just unbelievable. What he was trying to tell me, if I'd only have listened a little deeper, was he'd really like that rug to be put right in front of the fireplace, thank you very much, and then he would be just fine. And as soon as I said, oh, he wants the rug put there, and Bert would go, oh, I don't know, and I put the rug there, he was on it like that, and settled down, and, you know, he was with us. I have so many stories like that. This is a dog that was an unneutered male for quite a while. He was attacked often by other unneutered males, but Monty never responded in kind. He was so highly evolved in his personality that he would look at the other dog, and he might cry a bit, but he never attacked back. And Bert and I used to say, gee, I don't know if he could ever really sire puppies, you know, he doesn't seem to have any fight. But when I sat down and talked with the dog, I found out that he had plenty of fight if he needed to use it. Usually the dogs that attacked him were kind of lower on the dog consciousness scale than he was, and fairly young as well. So there's just so much going on in the lives of animals. If we have the least amount of ability to listen to that, you can hear. So I could go on all night about that. It was very hard for us to leave him, but luckily what happened was when Scott went to college, our vet told us that Monty just might not make it. He was so attached to Scott. And I started to pray, you know, and ask for guidance about this, because we knew we were going to be moving over here, Scott would be staying there, and we were going to have to find a house. And he didn't do well in kennels. He really liked to be with his family, and that was it. And so we rarely did that to him. But when a new family moved in next door who had a 5-year-old boy, my prayers were answered. Monty immediately trotted next door and made himself at home. And this child fell in love with him. He would get in this little boy's swimming pool, and he would allow the child to climb on his back and ride him. It was an amazing connection. And one day the neighbor came over and said, "You know, if you ever need a home for that dog, we are so in love with him." And I said, "Well, you know, I've been praying about that for the last 6 months, and you are just an answer. You know, the angels have really provided." And we left Monty, and we wrote for quite a long time. He never had 1 minute of missing. It's like he had said goodbye to Scott when Scott went to school, and he found his next boy and the next family that he would probably teach and work with. He is still alive. Shortly after we moved here, my son Scott, who stayed and went to school in Cal Poly, and myself had the very same dream on the same night, where Monty came to both of us and spoke to us and told us how happy he was, you know, and how he loved us. And that was the last time we saw him in the dream state. So I'll talk later a little bit about animals as dream symbols, too, because that's a really important part of dream life. Anyway, there's so many other stories I could share with you there. Have all of you got animals in your life as pets? Or I know you do. Lori has two wonderful goldens and a horse. One horse?
Three.
Three? Oh, I thought you sold one. Okay. Oh. Oh, and she has a big, wonderful Pee-wee cat. He's bigger than my Brandy was, I think. Doesn't Pee-wee weigh around 20 pounds or 18? He's a lovely big cat. Yes. Yeah, I can agree with that, having met him. Turn my mic on. I have a terrible time with that sometimes. Let's see. So to go on, I guess one thing I should mention is you might say something to your animal and mean something else. The animal always knows what you mean. The words might be saying one thing, but the animal, because it's developed emotionally and mentally, can see your field. It will see all the thought forms that are there or the auric colors that are happening. So if you're going to lie to your animal, it won't work. You know, if you're going to leave and your animal doesn't like it when you leave, don't tell them that you're not leaving. They'll know anyway. They just do. Whenever we leave now, we tell Scamper how long we're going to be gone. Although I'm not sure she has a concept of time, I try to send her pictures of how many sun risings and sunsets, you know. And when we come back, she's always out there on the rock. She seems to know when the day is that we're coming back. So that's important communication. Don't lie to them. Tell them the truth. I want to touch just briefly. I talked a little bit about they have to have purpose, but I want to say a little deeper about that. When an animal comes to you, this is especially true with domestic dogs, they have to have a responsibility in your family. A lot of cats really need that, too. So for dogs, it's good to let them know if they are the one who is to entertain, or if they are the protector, or if they are the playmate, or whatever it is. When you have a dog that's aggressive or unhappy, and the same for cats or any other animal, they're acting out just like humans act out when they're upset about things sometimes. And so it's good to find out what's their need and what is it they need to have to understand, so you can understand what's going on. For Monty, he was the companion, the great companion. That really was his role, and he was a teacher for us. For Brandy, he was not only Scott's companion, but he was the property keeper. He really kept the perimeter of our property. You know, it was ours, and he took care of that. For Scamper, she is more like the healer, the beautiful companion, that kind of thing. So if an animal doesn't have a clear idea of what its role in the family unit is, you might have some altercation going on, or they might be peeing where they're not supposed to, things like that. Brandy did not like to be left, and when we put him in the garage with his nice clean cat box, He always chose Burt's Wood projects to mark when we were gone, to let us know he really hated that and you better come back soon. You know? And we took some steps over the years to change that behavior. We gave him a really nice cozy place to sleep, or we made sure he had sunlight, which he always liked, and fixed up a little spot in the window for him to perch on and things like that. But anyway, it's important that they have their job to do. For some animals, it's like greeting you when you come home. They are the greeter. Scamper is a lot like that. She behaves like a dog when we come back. I was out front raking up leaves and stuff last week, and Bert drove up, and she had been asleep under the birch tree. She heard that truck coming. Boom, she was awake, and she trotted over and just stood in the driveway, you know, waiting for him. And he loves that, you know. We think, I honestly think she is Brandy come back to finish the work with Bert, and we'll talk about animals coming back. Brandy and Bert had some problems, and he was very patient until Bert got how wonderful Brandy was. And then Brandy died. You know, he kind of got that at the end of his life. So he and Scamp have quite a connection. One of the things that's really important with your animals is to let them know when change does occur. If there's a death, if there's a change of mate, if you're going to move. When we moved here, Scamp came with us from Atascadero, and she was quite young at the time. But I really had to let her know that her home, as she knew it, was going to be totally gone. She adapted remarkably quickly to living in a motel room, and she rode in the car with me without howling and carrying on. Whenever I went, you weren't supposed to have cats, really, in the motel, so I took her out when the maid cleaned, you know, and stuff like that, till we found where we were going to live. I want to touch on also that one of the things that we all need to remember are the animal friends who are still part of experimentation and chemical testing and all of that. Those who are trapped, those who are hunted for nothing more than sport. We really need to keep our prayer work going so that humanity will awaken to respect and appreciation for the creatures and the plants that share the planet with us. And you see more and more companies now that are saying they no longer animal test, but there's still a lot of them that do. And if you know anything about that, it's just excruciating. It's heartbreaking. I do want to share with you a story from one of the old books I have. This is a wonderful book if you can get it. These Two Shall Be Loved by Flower Newhouse. It's kind of an anecdotal book, but she's a spiritual teacher that had a place called Quest Haven in Southern California, and she loved animals. That was one of her greatest works. So the wild things would come to her, and all kinds of different animals. One of the stories that she relates, she doesn't give the person's name, but I think it's Farley Mowat that she's talking about. How many of you know Farley Mowat's work? Have you ever read any of? One of my favorites. And I didn't have him on the list. I might have one of his books on there, I'm not sure. But if you want to read a funny book, read Owls in the House. It'll just keep you laughing. Or there's another one that he wrote about, I think it's the dog named Mutt or something like that. And that dog learned to wear goggles and ride in the rumble seat with the owls going up and down. It's just, his family was utterly incredible. Anyway, when Farley was a young person, I think the story is about him. She says this young man went out hunting and he killed a thrush. And as he was crashing through the greenery or whatever to try to find this bird that he had shot, he found the area where he thought the bird was, but before he could get there, he saw this being with a great face looking from the tree down to the ground where the bird lay dead. And he stopped in his tracks and he looked at this face, which was not a human face, but it was a face nonetheless that was full of compassion and tenderness and just grief, you know, over the loss of this beautiful little friend. And he stared, and I can just see Farley doing this, he stared into this face, and he was changed forever at that moment, and he's never ever killed anything since. And what he did become is one of the greatest naturalists and environmental writers that we have. He grew up in northern Canada, and the stories of his boyhood are just remarkable. His experience with a skunk is one of the best, I think. Oh gosh. Anyway, I think that being that he saw was a tree spirit, you know, maybe that was the tree in which that little bird rested a lot of the time or had a nest. So these things happen, and there are the deeper parts of life that are happening in the forest when people are hunting. My brother has recently taken up bow hunting with a group of elk hunters. And I kind of cringed when he told me that, but I was relieved he wasn't shooting with a rifle, you know, or something like that. I figured, oh, Marvin will never get an elk. Well, he decided to learn how to make those lovely elk noises, and he got so good at it that he could go out in the woods, and the big bulls would come right to where he was, scared him to death. They'd stamp and blow at him and, you know, shake their big racks, and then they would very princely walk away. And Marvin has told me that he doesn't think he can ever kill one, having come that close to him and just looking at him and checking him out. And so we've done a little talk about animal communication. But he said, you know, Lil, I love being in the woods with those magnificent creatures. They're not frightened of me, and I can speak their language. I don't know what I'm saying, but I'm speaking it pretty well because they come right up to me. So I love that about Marvin. It's kind of neat that he's exploring that. Let's see, I'm going to talk a little bit about animal reincarnation or incarnation. In this book, I think Flower Newhouse is one of the few people I know who talks very clearly about the fact that she is more than certain that she's had many animals come back to her time and again, not just once, but sometimes three and four times throughout her lifetime. And sometimes they come back in the same breed, and sometimes they come back as a different breed, but the animal will display characteristics that belong to the first animal. She talks about a little dog named Cuddles that she just adored, and I think it was white, a little fluffy, like a little long-haired terrier, or maybe a little poodle mix or something. And when Cuddles died, she was really heartbroken, and not long after, a little black dog, same breed, showed up just about on her doorstep, and she took the dog in to take care of it, and she realized very quickly that Cuddles had come back, and this little puppy sat in the same place and liked the same things that her other dog did some of the same behaviors. She had another dog, a shepherd, that came back four different times throughout her life, I think, and just some remarkable stories. So she says that if you would like to have an animal return to you, you just have to ask if it's in divine order that that animal return. And then you have to do your part of being aware and staying intuitively open so you can recognize it, regardless of what breed it is, you know, and what color it is, that sort of thing. And she talks about the fact that some animals learn what they need in one breed, and then they move into another. If it's in the same species, they'll move into perhaps, I don't know, could be collie from having been a poodle or something like that. And the collie carries certain characteristics and qualities that the poodle doesn't have and vice versa. And it seems to be the case that animals have the ability to move through all species if they choose and to learn all different abilities and characteristics. And once they are at the top of the line, which as we see it is the ape family, the great apes, or maybe whales and dolphins, that kind of thing, then they have the ability to go on and move into some kind of a human form. It wouldn't be on this planet. It might be on a very young planet that's got the very early humanoid forms developing. On this planet, we had things like Cro-Magnon man and Neanderthal and some of the different early men. And we still don't know how it is that we as Homo sapiens came to be, whether there was intervention and we were, you know, or whether we were separately created or what. There's been no exact finding of that. There are lots of different theories. But for animals, apparently, their evolution is progressive, and so they do go on, and they retain everything that they've learned. Between lifetimes, let's see, whose book is this in? I think it's in Kinship with All Life by J. Allen Boone, I think is his name. He talks about a great playground over there or in the sky or something where an animal who's finally gone through all its evolutionary process will stay until its person or persons who loved it best Well, it went through its incarnations, crosses over, and then it does have permission to come and meet the person. And I can't tell you, if you sit with dying people very long or very many times, you will hear of them seeing an animal that they loved, you know, as a child or a young adult. Oh, there she is, you know, there's so-and-so come to greet me. It just happens all the time. And in the medical, the things that are being written now about death and dying, there are many stories like that. So they don't leave us, I think. And there are experiences, too, of when an animal crosses over, of them giving you an experience that they're still around or they know who you are and they remember. And in my family, the biggest experience happened to Bert when Brandy died. And he had just become real connected to him probably in the last 2 years of his life. And Brandy liked to get on Bert's lap, and Bert would sit in his recliner. And he was huge, kind of like Pee-wee, so he could stretch out the whole length of Bert's body, and, you know, he'd be just in heaven. Well, after Brandy died, Bert was sitting in that recliner one night, and all of a sudden I saw him leap out of that chair and fly across the room and going like this, and he said, "My God, it felt like Brandy just jumped on me." I said, "Well, he probably did. You know, he's still around, and he's letting you know." And he did come. He would feel him brush by you, or you would feel his energy come into the family room where the family would be in the evening. So many wonderful stories of things happening after an animal crosses over. And I've got a couple of them I want to share with you, too. Let me think of this. This is one of Flower Newhouse's again. She's just a wealth of stories. She had a cat named Twinkles who loved to come in her house and sit on one of her rocking chairs. It had upholstery on it. It was nice and cushy. So that was that cat's favorite chair. And I guess when Twinkles got very aged, she finally made the decision to put her to sleep because she was just struggling and suffering, I guess. And so one day after this cat had died, she heard the latch on her front door being rattled. So she got up and went to the door just thinking it was Twinkles. She just reacted. And when she got to the door and opened it, apparently this cat always did that to come in. It would rattle the latch. She felt something move by her, and then she turned around and looked in the room, and she saw the rocking chair rocking. So to her, that was a clear example of that cat letting her know it was still around and it still loved her, and that connection hadn't ended. There's another beautiful story that this one I heard. This comes from another healer named Corinne Helene. I don't even know if she's alive any longer, but she was a great metaphysical teacher. She had a Siamese cat named Triano, and this is what Corinne said. She seemed to have almost human intelligence. One summer she did get distemper, and when it appeared she would die one night, I sat up and kept watch, and at midnight, Triano lay very still with her eyes closed and seemed to be free of pain. Then she says she fell asleep. And suddenly, I was awakened by a sensation as though an electric current had gone through my body. I opened my eyes and saw a figure standing beside the bed, and she thought it was her husband who had come in the room to check on the cat. But when she looked a little closer, she saw that there was some kind of a light coming from this figure, and she knew then she was in the presence of an exalted being. And then she heard a voice whispering to her saying, "I am an angel of death." It leaned over her cat's body, and a shaft of light passed from the angelic being into her cat's body, Triano. And then Triano opened her eyes and looked long and tenderly into Corinne's eyes, gave two or three little gasps, and died. And then Corinne said that she saw a golden glow fill the whole room, and then it just dissipated. And she knew that her cat's spirit had been lovingly accepted, you know, and taken home. I just thought that was a beautiful story. I really liked it. One thing I might mention is each species does have an angelic being that overlights it, and you can just think of them as species guardian angels. So cats and dogs have their species guardian angel. And this angel really works with each of the different groups of animals as far as mating. They keep kind of in balance the numbers of animals, those who are coming and those who are dying. And one of the great gifts that this angel will give to an animal is that at the moment of death, it comes forward, like what this angel did in the story that Corinne told. And it brings an anesthesia, to the animal, so that it can release peacefully. If you think about animal death, and for myself personally anyway, and I've sat with many cats when they were dying, they all did it so gracefully. When Brandy died, he had kidney disease, and he went very rapidly. And it was such a teaching for me. There was no complaining. There was no moaning and groaning. There was no flailing about. There was just this relaxing into the process until the process was done. And at the time that he was very close to his death, he just would look at me, you know, and petting his head, or I'd put a drop of water in his mouth or something. And it was as though he had no pain. So when I came across this information in some of my reading, I thought that has to be true because that's what I've seen so often. So now it's not always the case. I know some people who've had animals that did struggle or did suffer and they needed to have them put down or something like that. But it seems in my experience that that is true. So I just wanted to share that with you. Yes.
But, and I didn't, your friend did, stayed up all night. She went and got me. I heard something look over the side of the bed, and she's staring at me in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
I followed her out, she's got a new family room, lay down. The lay down next to her, she just stared at me.
Oh, yes.
And she was, breathing erratically.
Mm-hmm. And that's just what humans do sometimes, yes.
And I fell asleep too, and I woke up thinking she was still alive.
Hmm.
So I said, okay, I took her to the vet, and I said, okay, you know, is it imminent? And they said, she isn't dying. She is shut down.
Mm-hmm.
She's not going to eat anymore. She's not going to do anything anymore. And I said, well, can you let her go? And he said, oh, she's suffering, you know, really.
It's an individual decision always. It really is. And I think it's up to the pet and the pet's owner. I've heard some awful stories of people with their superiority complex who come and demand that their animal be put down. And, you know, they give this superior talk about, I know it's her time to go, she's leaving. And the vet will ask, some of these people don't even do a physical or don't allow the vet to check the animal. One story in particular I heard is about it was a golden or I think or an Irish setter. And these people had this idea in mind that, you know, it was their dog and this dog was obviously dying and there nothing could be done. They tried everything. And he said, well, what did you try? Well, we did this, and this, you know, bland diet and homeopathic remedy, whatever their process was. And nothing worked, so the dog has to be put down. The vet said, well, did you see a vet? No, but we've come to you because we want you to put this dog down. And it turned out that the animal had an infected uterus, and the vet discovered that just on palpating the animal's abdomen and said, all I would have to do to heal the animal is to do a hysterectomy, if you would permit me. And they were adamant that the animal had to be put down. And that, he says, this is in a new book I got recently. I haven't even read the whole thing. I can't recall what the title is. Maybe it's on that book list. But anyway, he talks about the fact that he didn't feel this couple had asked their animal what the animal really wanted. And if they had really been in communication, they would have heard that the animal needed help. So he did do what the people wanted because he knew they would just take the dog to another vet. But he says he did whisper to the animal, I am sorry, you know, and ask that it have a very easy release and a better life and better people, hopefully, the next time. That's just one example. But I've heard many stories of people who are going now and sitting with their animals when they really, nothing else can be done. And deciding to have the vet help them and allow the animal to release. But other people choose to stay with their animals through the process. And it's a powerful teaching if you can do that. You know, some of us can and some of us can't. But there shouldn't be any guilt, I don't think, if you really have done everything possible, because the animal certainly doesn't hold it against us, you know. I fell asleep when one of my cats was dying, and I was mortified. I know the cat doesn't hate me, you know, but it's just an example of human feelings. Some do, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Especially cats that like to live outside more than they do inside. That's very true. That happened a lot when I was a child. Or I would find a cat, you know, hidden in the grasses under an apricot tree and obviously dying. Because we had quite a lot of cats that kept mice and rats down and things like that in the barns. And so I don't think most of them had shots. Only a very few had shots. So we had a lot of changing of the guard there with the cat people. Anyway, I just think that's such a personal thing that we can't sit in judgment on one another as long as we've done everything. This is a prayer request. I think this comes from Flower Newhouse again. It's a simple little thing that you can say at the death of a pet or after a pet has been gone, if you'd like that one to return. If it is the will of the Divine Presence for this animal to return to earth later, may I ask to be permitted to help that one and love that one again in the next embodiment. Very simple, but very direct. Okay. I want to share just a little bit about dream symbols, animals in dreams, because it's fascinating stuff, and we all have them. If you remember dreams, you've bound to have had animals in your dreams at some time in your life. Animals in dreams really can act as predictors. They can tell you of an upcoming event. They can tell you of what it is in yourself that still needs work. They can show you what you fear and what you're not confronting in your life. Oh, yeah. Okay. Bert must have set that up for some reason. There's just all different things, and probably Ted Andrews in his big book on all those animal thingies, he's probably got a lot of information in this regard. But I can give you some examples from my own life. When I first went to Sedona, I had a fabulous dream about a black leopard who approached me. She was sleek and elegant and solid muscle. You could just feel the power of this cat, but it was all contained, and she understood her power, which I did not at that time. And I'm still working with that one. In the dream, this beautiful, sleek leopard approached me, and those eyes, those kind of greenish-yellow eyes, looked at me for a long time. And then I saw her gather this velvet body. I knew she was going to leap right at me. And part of me had to make a decision. Do I turn and run, and do I drop into fear, or do I let this happen? And I decided to let it happen, and I just threw my arms open, and this magnificent beast leaped on me. And didn't hurt me at all. Those velvet paws wrapped around my neck, you know, and this face pressed on mine. It was such a tactile dream. And what I understood after that was that the power of this animal, she really was a symbol for me of female power, and how it could be quite coiled and strong and very present, but it can also be that yummy, loving, compassionate, everything else that is female, you know. And I had other dreams later where I had a great tigress that would show up. And it's the same idea. She spoke to me, too, about power and owning my personal power and not being afraid and all of those kinds of things. Other examples are things like if you've got, I don't know, it could be like a wild pig or a boar show up in your dream that's attacking you. Sometimes this is letting you know that you're going to have that kind of person maybe in the next day or the next week or so. Someone that's insensitive, that's in your face, that's unapproachable or just totally out of control, you know, that you have to deal with. Someone I know had a dream once about a hippo, and, you know, what the heck could this possibly be about, Lil? Well, you have to think about what is a hippo like. They have really thick skins. They're really kind of, you know, cantankerous. They do what they want to do when they want to do it. You can't train a hippo and stuff like that.